as we were talking about your extracurricular interests, I've read that in this period in 58-59, during some of your business trips to New York City, you visited what was then, I think, a new museum, the Museum of Primitive Art,
yes.
and began to get engaged with African art.
Yeah.
You could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I've always had an interest in Africa from my early days, and it's fascinated me as a continent, all aspects of it. And then when I was taking very frequent business trips to New York steadily during this whole period, and which was the center of African art dealing at the time and connoisseurship, and it was just developing as a field then. From the standpoint, it was always treated as ethnographic material in the back room,
mm-hmm.
and you'd stick art masterpieces next to some dumb spear or something like that. And just the time I started collecting, again, it was just like the other stuff, many of the other things, I was there at the right time when it started to develop as an art movement, in large part to Nelson Rockefeller, who set up the Museum of Primitive Art. And it was a personal love of his to start that museum. And I went there to see this stuff, and I was just really, really impressed with it.
Mm.
And as you can see around the house here, I've could satisfy my interest in abstract shapes and forms to my heart's content. So I started in 1960 making a few tentative purchases,
mm-hmm.
and focused on abstract cups from one particular tribe. I've always I didn't realize at the time, but realize the extraordinary value of the serial image, where you're comparing two related things and you see something a lot more than you see them individually. So a series, a grouping of things is the powerful way to look at them. So I've always collected in some kind of depth, mm-hmm. or get alternate examples or something. So African art was just perfect for me in that. At that time, it was very inexpensive. You could afford to make mistakes. African art started flowing in from Africa with the transportation system developing.
Mm-hmm.
People could fly to Africa instead of going by some godforsaken boat. And so you could go from Paris to Africa on a weekend,
right,
and back again. And with all the political, with all the countries becoming politically independent, there was a lot of turmoil, and a lot of old tribal ideas were destroyed, so that material came on the market.
Mm.
So for this and a whole bunch of other reasons, there was a lot of material coming onto the market in the 60s that nobody had any idea what it was. It was this unknown stuff, and it was just great fun to try to make sense out of it.
Mm.
And so I could judge it by my interest in the abstract form rather than anything I read. There were practically no books written on the subject then.
Mm.
Just like solid-state physics. So I started collecting, and my interest gradually grew until it turned into a major activity in my life.
Mm.
And I focused on, if I had a focus, it was on the art of the Lega people in eastern Zaire, who make marvelous small carvings, and I built probably certainly the biggest collection of that stuff that's around, which I've now given to UCLA, and we had a show at UCLA, right, which is a traveling show that's going around now, and they did a good catalog, so the material's well documented.
And was it the abstract forms in that,
yeah,
small sculpture?
And the variety and the degree of imagination and the visual puns, and the thing looks different from the front and the back, and this. And I've had the access to see both all the museum collections and the dealer's back rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a chance, and collectors, so I've had a chance to see probably more of this material than anybody else.
Mm.
I had the freedom to travel. So that was a big, major emphasis of my own. And after I was collecting a while, my interest in this was known. It's a very small dealers and collecting community. Mm-hmm. And dealers knew my interest, so when an interesting new piece comes on the market, I get first crack at it.
Right.
And working out relations with dealers where I didn't take advantage of them and I paid them on time and I was easy to negotiate with, pays untold dividends. You pay 10% or 20% more for something and then you get the next one.
Right.
So that's always been my philosophy of collecting.
And with those, you are making frequent business trips to New York to sort of deal with the home office of, or the headquarters of Fairchild, or was that for recruiting? Or
it would be industry meetings and go to the electronic shows. I never had anything to do with the Fairchild management as such,
mm-hmm.
and. Well, by then I had left Fairchild, so I was doing
right.
Teledyne things.
Okay.
And just a host of things. We started from our first division. By the time I left, we had 150. And my job near the end was trying to make sense out of all these various divisions. And so I was traveling all over the place.
Sure.
All over the world for a long period. So I had a chance to have a strong art collecting things as part of a business thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was at Fairchild, I left for a month to climb Mount Kilimanjaro and set that up for a pattern that existed for the next decade at least, where I said to people at Fairchild and then later to Melkus, I'm going to be gone a month a year, and you have to judge me by my annual output rather than my daily output. but it's something I've to revitalize myself, I need to do.
Mm.
So I've traveled all over the world, and a lot of, when looking back on, I was single, so I wasn't that concerned about risking my life, and I did some pretty interesting stuff.
That was mostly what you would do for that month, is travel.
I did. I had backwoods Ethiopia, and where I was using a guidebook written in 1520.
Really?
And nothing had changed. I was way in the boonies. So I could combine my interest in, and as I became more of an expert in African art, it's a very small community of serious collectors. So I made friends all over the world. I can go to Paris or Brussels or any of these cities, and I have a real good friend. They come here, and so it's been a lot more than a solitary collecting
right.
experience, and it's one I value. And now it's like all these things, nobody realizes how rare they think there's an infinite amount.
Yeah,
if there's three pieces and two collectors,
yeah.
And then this phenomenon of a very slight change. And the external parameters making an enormous change in their output.
Mm-hmm.
Like two more right. cars on a freeway, instead of going 60, you're going 10.
Right.
And it was a very small input. And so this had happened with African art, and it gradually dried up, so now there's essentially no material coming from Africa, and everybody's taking in each other's laundry, and the same piece gets recirculated, so there's a lot higher emphasis on quality, and the high quality pieces sell for a lot. You can't give away the lower quality pieces. but I was fortunate enough to be collecting during this whole period while all this started from ethnographic and gradually settled itself out.
Mm.
So now collecting is not that interesting. I just don't see pieces that intrigue me that much on the market. And once in a while I do see them, and they're just horribly overpriced.
Mm.
I mean, these prices have gone up a factor of 100 at least.
Oh my goodness.
On a lot of the stuff. So it's been a rich part of my life, collecting this stuff.
And was that really brought you to, I guess some topics we'll talk about later on, but to your engagement with collecting the African art, really getting you into other aspects of art history and art collecting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I came to Southern California, then I started seeing my first Orange Crate labels. And just, again, it was looking at these things that were used in the same format, same size, from 1880 to 1955, I could see that this was a, in miniature poster form, was a documentation of art movements this whole period, which is the thesis of my book.
Right.
And at that time they were inexpensive, and with my partner Gordon, we could track down lots of them. And the same thing has happened there.
Right, partly as a result of your book, I'm sure.
Yeah, the book made some, but still it was a very active collecting thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but there my interest then spread beyond the labels as such to the manufacturing techniques and to my present interest of writing history of color lithography.
Mm. Right.
So just one thing led to another.
To the other.
And I've done a lot of writing about documenting this change in 1960 to the present, and collecting ability and changes and all of this stuff. And I've conducted oral histories with the key dealers who said, well, most of them said, well, I'm not going to discuss this, but I'll discuss it with you. We get going. I just have some marvelous stories. So I've taken my interest in history into that whole collecting area.
As well, yeah.
There's certainly a lot of future writing I'd like to do and all these things. Make some more sense out of all this.
Mm-hmm.
But art has always been a rich part of my life. I met my wife, who was the first person that I'd met who understood African art to some extent.
So
we hit it off right away.
Was she also involved in collecting, or
she's an anti collector. That's right. What neatness there is in these houses. Where are you going to put it? Mine, that's the last thing on my mind. But as you can see, you don't see a whole lot of American ephemera around the house here. That's something I keep compartmentalized for everyone.
Right.
And also, I don't want to look at it all the time.
When you're working with it, sure.
So it's worked out, and I've had the opportunity to spend as much time as I wanted to on various aspects of art collecting.
Right.
And as I said, it wasn't terribly expensive, and I had the resources to do what I wanted to do.
So again, very, very good timing.
Yeah.
Well, to go back then in the chronology to 58-59, when you're first getting engaged with African art, you first get engaged in something that's another sort of revolutionary development in the integrated circuit story. And, you know, there seems to, in my reading, there seems to be a haze of sort of confusion about, or not confusion, but an indeterminacy, a ferment at the time in this period about ideas about making integrated circuits. And some people have written about there being a certain buzz in the technical community that Texas Instruments was doing something in this domain. Mm. What was your experience of first hearing about integrated circuits?
Well, to get into 58, by the summer of 58, we had made our first transistor and had set up production stuff, and I had written some process manuals about how you transfer stuff to production, so by then it was compartmentalized, and the pre-production engineers were doing it,
mm-hmm.
and my role of researcher or doing what I could do to help build the first transistor was no longer needed.
Right.
And Gordon was heavily involved in the engineering aspect of it then, and after Noyce took over general management, he started running the R&D. And I was more or less at loose ends, and I started working for a while on the parametric amplifier diode that looked like it was going to be a a very useful switching device. I worked on that for a while. So that would be the first months of 59.
Mm-hmm.
And there was what buzz there was on, it was a military buzz saying we need very small components. And they were going at it, what seemed to me at the time wrong, and even more so now, molecular engineering, where you fabricate components out of the blue by just laying down atoms in them. Or a very sort of watchmaking approach of sticking little components together. So there was a lot of talk like that, all of it military based, all of it, which turned out nearly all both technically and economically unsound.
Hmm.
So there was a lot of talk about that. TI got going in early 58, Kilby wrote his patent, but that suffered from the serious limitation that they didn't have a good flat transistor to put in this thing, so it was really just a hodgepodge of saying the ability we can put more than one component on a piece of silicon.
Mm-hmm.
Was essentially all they were saying then. But they started making a lot of noise about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at Westcon that year, I remember specifically, which would be August of 59. Noyce and I had a talk before that. Noyce said, we have to show the flag at Westcon, and let's figure out a jury rig, some little device that we can show on Westcon, said we too are in the miniature integrated circuit world. And I built this little thing. It was just a little oscillator. I just stuck four transistors on a chip and made some resistors with a lead pencil. But it said we were doing it, and it got a lot of publicity. And at that time, there had been previously, there's some famous meeting that Noyce had discussing all the future of this stuff. Moore said he was not at that meeting. Right. I was certainly not at it. And Jean Hernie was not at it. So I
it was there.
It just got into the folklore some way, as far as I'm concerned. So I had no real talks with Noyce about integrated circuits. I did see one note on this weekly report that in March I was going to be in one of my side jobs, be looking at miniature circuits or integrated circuits, but nothing ever came of that at that time. So at that time about Westcon time, October, the decision was made that I was going to start running a group to make integrated circuits.
Right before the meeting?
It started with making this little jury. I still had that jury rig circuit. But it was just saying that we were going to be in this business.
Were there real technical challenges to making that? Because you're talking about it very sort of...
No.
It was very straightforward.
Well, it was. It was just putting a couple... You had to start with a ceramic plate and stick loose transistors on it and fasten them down and hitch them up with a wire. And it just showed that we were thinking along this line.
Mm-hmm.
And without it... Then I was given the mandate to set up and run a group, build the group and run it, to build the circuits.
And so in late 59?
That would be, it would be starting in like September.
Right.
I hired Lionel Katner from TI, Mark Weisenstern, Izzy Haas joined the group, he had been reporting to Bob Norman, or indirectly to Dick Greenwich.
Mm-hmm.
He joined the group. And I built up a group of maybe a dozen people and had them in place by December of 59 would be.
And so was this group then in the Fairchild Research and Development Organization?
Yeah.
Then?
Yeah, it was just another thing there.
In there.
And nobody seemed to care much about it one way or the other. And, understandably, I mean, Fairchild was starting to really explode in its transistor business and setting up a diode plant, setting up European, Asian fabrication plants. And this and getting the price low enough that it could get into the automobile market, mm-hmm. all of these things. And that understandably occupied everybody's attention, and it should have. And so this was just a side little venture, and nobody... everybody talks about the idea of the integrated circuit
mm-hmm.
that would occur to any thinking person in 5 minutes. Thought about, you got these devices and let's figure out how to hitch them up without taking them apart. So the idea wasn't hard, but the thing that stopped everybody dead, it was the yield question.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a 5% yield and you multiply that to the eighth power, you could prove mathematically you could never build an integrated circuit.
Right.
And which was but we did have the planar technology that nobody else had.
Right.
And I don't know how the ideas got from Noyce's notebook into the work I was doing. And I think it was a fairly indirect... I never saw the notebook. I didn't know that it existed. And I don't recall that, other than just a casual talk with Bob about the direction we're going to proceed on this. But I could quickly see that the big problem was not interconnecting the devices. It was electrically isolating one from the other.
Right.
And that was the thing that stopped us dead. Because we had all the metallization and the etching techniques to make all the wires. We didn't have any way to have them overlap or anything, but we could design our way around that.
Mm-hmm.
So the big problem was electrical isolation.
Mm-hmm. To go back a couple steps, so this was this in terms of the R&D organization... to have a dozen people at this time strikes me as a pretty big group.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
And so Noyce did his patent filing, in July of 59, but that essentially wasn't in your orbit at all.
I didn't know that he had filed it. A couple of years later, I didn't know it was.
And so it was really, and by this time also, that the planar technology had sort of proven itself with the transistors.
Yeah.
So that,
mm-hmm.
so it was, it would have been quite odd for you not to have adopted the planar process.
Oh, yes. No, that was.
It was your technology.
Michael Wolf wrote an early article of what is about the genesis of the integrated circuit. And I think Vic Greenwich, somebody said, where did the idea come from? It was just an obvious idea that had been around. As I said, it wasn't the idea as much as it was the serious obstacles to make the thing and make it work.
Right.
So
at this time, had Gordon Moore taken on the role of of overseeing R&D then?
Yeah, so I reported to Gordon on this.
What was his attitude toward the project to build one? To build an integrated circuit, his attitude toward it, involvement with it?
Well, he was supportive and interested and followed along with what I was doing, but it was not anything we looked on it as a commercial, you know, our commercial future wasn't going to depend on it.
Right.
And Gordon, after the fact, made this remark, well, now we made the integrated circuit, what do we do next?
Right.
That was sort of the attitude. It was an existence proof.
Right.
Without a really powerful commercial application, unless it was an extremely expensive, specialized, expensive things, which proved to be the case, because it was really 5 years before integrated circuits started making any mark at all.
Mm.
Very frustrating period. So. So at that time we had a lot of money, and Fairchild was really booming, and so the question of hewing to a tight budget never seemed to come up, or
mm-hmm.
if there were problems that Gordon faced with that, I didn't burden me with them.
Could you tell me the story of working toward making these first integrated circuits? I mean, how did you get on top of the isolation problem?
Well, there were two ways that you could do this. One would be to diffuse a boron isolation the whole way through the wafer,
mm-hmm.
and boron was acting up and a 15-minute diffusion, and this would be an 18-hour diffusion. So you just couldn't figure out how to keep everything from melting or blowing up or anything. So I set up to make the first diffusion by absolute brute force, which was to take an isolated wafer with oxide on the surface,
mm-hmm.
and fasten it to a plate, and then on the back, etch the whole way through the silicon until you got down to the oxide,
mm-hmm.
and then fill that with some insulating material,
oh.
which was really a brute
mm-hmm.
force approach. But that's the way the first integrated circuits were made.
Hmm.
And there was a famous picture in Life magazine of the first integrated circuit, and that illustrates that first device made by that technology. And
what sort of material were you?
Oh, there were, we tried. I had chemist Sam Folk,
mm-hmm.
did nothing exploring strange isolating materials, epoxies and ceramic based materials. Zauerreisen is the name that comes to mind. And so it was a brute force, but we made circuits fairly short order that way. We couldn't make them very reproducibly, and faced problems that we had to line up the pattern on the front of the device with the etching on the back, and we developed an infrared system to look through the wafer in infrared where the silicon would be transparent,
okay.
so we could see the front. And we've actually built this really complicated alignment device. To do this. So, but by Lionel Katner was actively involved in doing a lot of the layout work,
mm-hmm.
and Izzy Haas was doing a lot of work on device evaluation and made interesting experiments, like take reject devices and see if you can make an integrated circuit of them, because a transistor has to be all things to all people and meet 20 parameters on a data sheet. But here you could define the absolute use of the transistor, so it didn't have to meet a lot of other criteria on breakdown voltage and things.
Mm-hmm.
And you were making them all at the same time, so that if it was just a variation in temperature or something, it would probably just need to match.
Mm-hmm.
And so all I had to do was find a big enough hunk of silicon that there wasn't some local defect on that particular part that would stop you dead.
Mm-hmm.
So with Izzy making integrated circuits and jump transistors, it gave us enough of a feeling that we were on the right track.
And that happened how quickly?
I think we made the first device. Lionel laid out the masks in December of 59, and I think we made one or two devices.